Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Susan Shand, Alice Bryant, and Jill Robbins. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
A months-long drought affecting most of southern Africa has led to serious food shortages for millions of people. The United Nations estimates that more than 11 million people are currently facing crisis levels of food insecurity. The World Food Program says southern Africa has received normal rainfall in just one of the past five growing seasons. Among the hardest hit areas is South Africa's Northern Cape province. There, many farmers are struggling to keep their families and animals alive as they lose money and debt grows. Sheep farmer Louis van der Merwe told the Associated Press he had lost more than 400 sheep and 450 springbucks over the past 2 years. He said the current drought is the worst he has seen during his 45 years of farming. Some of his animals died of hunger. Others were harvested earlier than normal to reduce the number of animals he had to feed. Van der Merwe got emotional while explaining that he now accepts donations of animal feed so he can keep the rest of his animals alive. "If we didn't have hope, we would not be here anymore," he said. "We have to have hope and faith. There are a couple of times when we have felt it is not worth it." One farmers' organization estimates that South Africa's Northern Cape province will need at least $28 million over the next 3 months to assist 15,500 affected farms. So far, South Africa's government has promised $2 million. Gertruida Buffel lives in the Northern Cape town of Vosburg. She told the AP that things have gotten so bad that she now shares her family's food with their animals. For 2 weeks, she fed two small lambs a mixture of dried corn and water after their mother starved to death. But she said one lamb ended up dying, likely because the corn mixture was not part of the lamb's usual diet. Small children are hungry too. At Vosburg's only school, Delta Primary School, large groups of children line up every morning for what becomes both breakfast and lunch. The meal usually includes cornmeal, vegetables, and soup. The school food program began before the drought, but teachers say it has become increasingly important for the town's struggling families. "It's very hard for the parents to actually feed their children at home," one teacher said. In Kimberley, the capital of Northern Cape, government officials give out money from the $2 million disaster aid program. The job can be difficult because some farmers live in places that are not easy to get to. Farmers Jan Lu and Martiens Tietis are among those hoping to receive government-provided animal feed. but they are not expecting any assistance until January. Until then, they plan to keep sharing feed with other farmers to keep their animals alive. I'm Brian Lynn.
For several years, the worldwide financial crisis that began in 2008 had little effect on Vietnam's banks. That is not because its banks were stronger than the U.S. banks that created the crisis. It was mostly because of the country's lack of international trade. But today, Vietnam does much more trade around the world, and the government is taking steps to make sure its banks can deal with a financial shock. The government, for example, is asking banks in Vietnam to look at environmental, social, and governance risks, ESG, when considering credit risk. The State Bank of Vietnam says that every bank will create a unit for ESG analysis by 2025. ESG risk must be considered in all decisions. 17 banks in Vietnam have set up these units to analyze the environmental and social effects of their lending. 25 banks have made such analysis so far, the central bank said. Nguyen Quoc Hoang is a director of credit policies at the State Bank of Vietnam. Nguyen said Vietnamese banks are ready to create sustainable finance, which is important for finding new business opportunities. The push for banks and other businesses to consider their effects on the environment has created new expressions like green finance and green bonds. Green finance means, for example, giving a loan to a business that provides wind power. Green finance is important to Vietnam. It considers itself one of the countries most threatened by the effects of climate change. The government is strengthening its banks because of its membership in the Sustainable Banking Network, SBN. That is a group of 38 developing countries pushing ESG rules. The World Bank's International Finance Corporation also supports the group. The 38 nations share ideas about green finance, said Iman Sia. He is on the SBN working group. Like many Indonesians, he goes by one name. Sharing lessons and knowledge among members has been an important way to drive finance reforms, Iman Sia said. His country, along with China, is among the leaders of the 38 countries. Both Indonesia and China have started using many of the planned ESG policies. These include government financial support for green investments. Vietnam may soon be among the leading countries, too. A World Bank report said of the country, Vietnam is one of the few SBN members to require banks to report the quantities and values of their green loans. Considering the social value of loans is much harder to measure. But Vietnam's banks want to avoid the kind of risky loans that led to the near collapse of the U.S. housing market in 2008. I'm Susan Shand.
Drug-resistant superbug infections have been called a public health threat that could push medical progress back a century. Health experts warn such infections could cause some germs to become untreatable. So there was surprising news in a recent report. Superbug deaths in the United States appear to be going down. About 36,000 Americans died from drug-resistant infections in 2017, compared to an estimated 44,000 in 2013. That information comes from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC. The recent CDC report says the decrease is mainly the result of a major effort by hospitals to control the spread of very dangerous infections. "We are pushing back in a battle we were losing," pharmacist Michael Kirsch told the Associated Press. He works at Advent Health Tampa, a Florida hospital that has noted lower superbug infection rates. "I would not by any means declare success," Kirsch said. And he's right. Though superbug deaths are decreasing, non-fatal infections grew nationally from 2.6 million in 2013 to 2.8 million in 2017. Some troublesome new germs are developing, and superbugs are appearing much more often outside of hospitals, the CDC report said.
For example, urinary tract infections have been easily treated in doctors' offices with common antibiotic medicines. But now it is more common to see healthy young women with such infections admitted to hospitals after their treatments do not work, said Dr. Bradley Frazee. He works at a hospital emergency room in California. "We never really worried about this kind of antibiotic resistance in the past," said Frazee. Last year, he was lead writer of a report which noted more than 1,000 drug-resistant urinary tract infections at Highland Hospital in Oakland. Antibiotic drugs first became widely available in the United States during the 1940s. And today, antibiotics are used to kill or control bacteria that cause all kinds of infections, from strep throat to the plague. But some antibiotics have stopped working. Experts say overuse and misuse have made these drugs less effective. The new CDC report marks only the second time the government agency has tried to measure the numbers of U.S. illnesses and deaths linked to drug-resistant germs. The first report was released 6 years ago. This time, the CDC used new information and re-examined the 2013 numbers. This led to larger estimates. The 2013 report estimated that superbugs were to blame for more than 23,000 U.S. deaths and more than 2 million infections each year. Those numbers were based on 17 germs that were considered the greatest threat,
But the 2013 count did not include the thousands of deaths and illnesses from a nasty bug called Clostridium difficile. It is considered part of the larger problem because when antibiotics kill other bacteria, C. diff can grow uncontrollably. The good news is C. diff infections and deaths have also been decreasing. Overall, public health officials admit the superbug problem is probably even bigger. A 2018 paper suggested more than 153,000 Americans die each year from infections resulting from two or more drug-resistant organisms.
Among the CDC's other findings, there were fewer cases of several nasty hospital-related germs, including drug-resistant tuberculosis and the bug known as MRSA. Infections from the bacteria CRE, often called the nightmare bacteria, stayed about the same instead of increasing. U.S. health officials credit hospitals for using antibiotics more carefully and doing more to isolate patients with resistant infections. They also believe government money for laboratories has helped researchers more quickly identify drug-resistant germs and take action against them. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Years of disagreement between the North and the South finally burst into civil war in April of 1861. Seven states in the South had withdrawn from the Union. Soldiers of the new Confederate States of America shelled the Union base at Fort Sumter, built on an island in Charleston Harbor in South Carolina. They captured Fort Sumter after 2 days. President Abraham Lincoln asked the states of the Union for 75,000 soldiers to help end the Southern Rebellion. Northern states quickly sent forces to Washington. But border states, those between the North and the South, refused to send any. Some prepared to leave the Union and join the Confederacy. Steve Ember and Shirley Griffith describe the first days of the American Civil War.
The first state to secede after the start of the Civil War was Virginia. It was an important state because of its location. It was just across the Potomac River from Washington. Virginia's decision to secede cost the Union a military commander of great ability. He was Robert E. Lee. Lee was a Virginian and had served in the United States Army for more than 30 years. Lincoln asked him to be head of the Army when General Winfield Scott retired. Lee said he could not accept the job. He said he opposed secession and loved the Union. But, he said, he could not make war on his home state. Lee resigned from the Army. He did not really want to fight at all. But soon after his resignation, he agreed to command the forces of Virginia.
Virginia's forces moved quickly after the state seceded. A group of 1,000 soldiers went to Harper's Ferry, Virginia, where the Union Army had a gun factory and arsenal. It was the same town where abolitionist John Brown had tried to start a slave rebellion a few years before. The United States force at Harper's Ferry was small. The soldiers could not defend the town against the Virginians, so they left. Before marching away, the soldiers set fire to the gun factory and arsenal. The fire did not destroy all the equipment at the gun factory. When the Virginians captured the town, they sent the equipment south, where it was used to make guns for Confederate soldiers.
Virginia's forces also moved against the United States' biggest Navy base, which was at Norfolk, Virginia. Once again, the Union force withdrew. Before leaving, it burned every building and sank every ship. President Lincoln was becoming increasingly worried about Virginia's military moves. He was afraid Confederate forces in Virginia might try to capture Washington in the first days of the war. After all, the Confederate Secretary of War had declared that the Confederate flag would fly over the Capitol building before the 1st of May. Washington was not strongly defended. It did not have enough soldiers to stop any real attempt by Confederate forces to seize the city. It was extremely important to get more soldiers to Washington as quickly as possible.
Thousands of men were on their way to Washington, but they could not get there quickly. Troop trains had to pass through the state of Maryland to get to Washington from the north. Many people in the state supported the Confederacy. The governor, however, did not. He refused to call a meeting of the state legislature. He was afraid it might vote to secede. He wanted to keep Maryland neutral. The first troop train from the north passed through Baltimore, Maryland, without incident. The second train was not so lucky. A mob blocked the rail line and threw stones at the train. Shots were fired. 4 soldiers and 12 civilians were killed. State and city officials met to discuss the trouble. They agreed that there would be even more violence in the future. So they ordered railroad bridges outside Baltimore destroyed. No more trains from the north could reach Washington that way.
President Lincoln told the officials of the great need to get more soldiers to the Capitol. He agreed that they did not have to pass through Baltimore. But he wanted them to be able to land safely at Annapolis, a city on the Chesapeake Bay. Landing at Annapolis would be easy. Getting to the capital would not. Supporters of the Confederacy had damaged trains, rail lines, and bridges between the two cities. The first soldiers to land at Annapolis had to repair everything as they moved ahead. Still, with all these difficulties, 10,000 troops made it to Washington in the first few weeks of the Civil War. The city and government were safe.
President Lincoln worried about the presence of Confederate supporters in Maryland. He knew they would continue to be a threat to the movement of Union troops and supplies. Lincoln wanted to restrict the activities of the Confederate supporters, so he took an extremely unusual step for an American president. He put much of Maryland under military rule. He gave military officers the power to arrest civilians believed to be hostile to the Union. and he gave them the power to hold these suspects without trial. This order suspended two of the basic rights under the Constitution. One was the right to go free until officially charged, and the other was the right to a speedy trial. The Chief Justice of the United States wrote a letter to President Lincoln. He said the Constitution did not give the President the power to suspend the rights of citizens. Lincoln disagreed. He felt the situation facing the Union permitted him to take such strong measures. If he had not acted, he believed, Maryland would have seceded.
Maryland did not withdraw, but North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas did. There were now 11 states in the Confederacy. There could be two more. No one knew how long Kentucky and Missouri would remain in the Union. Both supported the Southern rebels. President Lincoln treated Kentucky carefully. He did not want the state to secede, nor did he want it to remain neutral. Kentucky reached from the mountains of Virginia to the Mississippi River. As a neutral state, Kentucky could block Northern troops from much of the South. Lincoln wanted it firmly on the side of the Union. The president did not use force in Kentucky, as he had done in Maryland. Instead, he sent people to Kentucky to organize support for the Union. Newspapers were urged to publish pro-Union statements. Home Guard forces were formed. They received their weapons and supplies from Lincoln's administration. Lincoln hoped that in time these efforts would win Kentucky's support for his war effort.
In Missouri, the governor tried hard to take the state out of the Union. He called a convention to decide the question. A majority of the delegates refused to vote for secession. The governor organized state soldiers. The Lincoln administration organized Home Guard forces. The two sides clashed several times. Some civilians were killed. The United States Army finally seized government buildings in the state capital. They forced state officials, including the governor, to flee. Missouri would remain in the Union.
The capital of the Confederate States of America was located far south in Montgomery, Alabama. Within the first few weeks of the Civil War, the Confederate Congress voted to move the capital farther north to Richmond, Virginia. They believed Virginia would be an important battlefield in the war. They were right. 2 days before Confederate President Jefferson Davis left for Richmond, Union troops invaded Virginia. They left Washington, crossed the Potomac River, and seized the towns of Arlington and Alexandria. No shots were fired. Confederate forces withdrew as Union troops moved forward. Within a month, thousands more Union soldiers were in Virginia. They were to prepare for a major battle at a place called Manassas Junction, or Bull Run.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.